This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 442 podcast. I'm James Brown, editor-in-chief of the magazine. And today I'm joined by three of our regular writers, two staff, one contributor, with tales of their trip to the Champions League final in a camper van that I managed to get hold of them from. What's the magazine called?
Practical Motorhome.
Practical Motorhome. We have to thank them for that. James Moore is deputy editor of the magazine, and Hunting Godson is our staff writer and looks after the mixer section. Both are Spurs fans. I imagine their journey there was better than the journey back. And they were joined by Tony Evans, who is a Liverpool fan and the only member of the writing team there who could drive. So thank God Liverpool won from that respect. And you had a friend along who was another Liverpool fan, didn't you?
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, there were a couple of moments when we thought of leaving the two of them. I thought that'll give them a real adventure. You know, driving off into the distance. But no, it was good. It was, and they were very good company. And
more on that in a moment, Tony. We'll also look at the latest edition's preview of the Women's World Cup, Andy Mitten's amazing piece with Diego Maradona that made the news this week, and we'll also take a look at the Nations League as well. But first, let me take you back to last Saturday. All the way there, or did you and your mate split it?
I did a fair amount of the driving, but he did some. You know, it's an easy, great, honestly, motorhomes, they're the next big thing. Forget your sports cars. It's brilliant. It drove really well, like, you know, up at 90 on the motorway, you know, just overtaking everything. I mean, you know, shouting abuse at everyone I overtook. You know, it's like, you're being overtaken by a motorhome. What kind of human are you? Because, you know, if you had a rail car, you wouldn't accept that, would you? But anyway, no, it was brilliant.
And what route did you take?
We took the tunnel to Calais. Then we drove down.
Did you went on the train?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then
people who've never done that find it weird.
That was the first time I had done that. That was the first time I'd been on a train in any kind of wheeled vehicle, let alone a massive motorhome.
When I had my own publishing company about 15 years ago, Jack Barclay, I think they called him, Barclay Square, sent round a Bentley. And Leeds with a fucking beautiful Bentley. I don't know why I sent it round. I think he was trying to get me to buy one. And Leeds were playing the team called Troyes. There isn't a place called Troyes. It's like Arsenal. It's moved. Troyes is the name of the club. It was in the Champagne region of France. And four or five of us went down in this Bentley. Obviously just dressed like we are now, not looking like the sort of people who would be driving a Bentley. As we drove it onto the train at Ashford, the guy said to one of my mates, said, "Delivering it, lads?" And they turned and went, "No, it's his." And the look of just confusion of the bloke's face was brilliant. But when we got on the motorway in France, because a lot of people don't use it because you've got to pay, it was great to drive on.
Oh, yeah, you know, those toll roads, I mean, you know, there's not that much traffic on it, so you just fly down them. I mean, that wasn't so bad. Once you get to Bordeaux, there's a stretch from Bordeaux down to the Spanish border. That's a pain. You know, and that was bad coming back. Mm. And then once you get into the Basque country, it's like, you know, it's winding mountain roads, the motorway. You know, and
so was it? You had a nice drive.
Yeah, it was nice driving. Not to show the boys in the back.
It was very comfortable for the two Tonys in the front, but for me and Hunter in the back, it was a little bit harem-scarum at times, and we didn't have quite the same...
Was it like that opening scene of Breaking Bad? which you have a gas mask and your underpants and flying around in the back.
It was, yeah. The thing is, you'd move in the front and it moves like a car, but then the back reacts about a second later.
Yeah.
So while like they're going that way, motor. And then we're turning.
What were you sitting on? Were you? Was there a
it was like a sofa. So it was just like a sofa with two belts on it, basically.
So without sides.
So you were sitting sideways.
No, we were no, sitting, no, we were facing forward.
So what's wrong with that? A sofa with seat belts? That sounds better.
It was. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying, when we got to those roads in Spain, you knew we were going around some bends because the back end was flying around.
And where did you park up at night? Because if you ever go somewhere like the Isle of Skye, which are obviously plagued by motorhomes, you can't park anywhere unless you're in a dedicated like motorhome car park. Was it like that, or did you find some camping resorts or?
So on the first night, it was sort of planned, and then that plan went out the window, and we ended up in Bernay, which is a lovely little village.
It's quite saucy.
And that was in a supermarket car park. We ended
oh, lovely!
Up. Yeah.
I mean, that really takes the edge off, doesn't it?
And yeah. A beautiful view of the recycling bins.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't that glamorous, and we went and found a little place that was still open, had a few beers, and sort of chatted about the game.
And the woman there, very kind, she was about to close, wasn't she? And Tony had to kind of sweet talk her in kind of pidgin English to stay open, if you don't mind me saying, by the way.
What does Scouse French sound like?
Oh, beer and finger gestures. Yeah, I mean... you know, she was about to shut. Actually, it wasn't me. She thought it was on my own. So she was like, oh, you know, no. And then she looked down the street and saw the...
Oh, like the old female hitchhiker trap.
Yeah, and thought, oh, you know, I'll make a few quid out of these. And she did, you know, we had a few. So that was quite nice. And the second night, we stayed about 2 hours north of Madrid in a proper campsite.
Okay.
Which was fantastic, which had a bar and a restaurant. And the food was... brilliant.
Do you know what? It's great hearing this because this was a pretty much of a spur of the moment thing. James, you got your ticket as a Spurs season ticket holder.
Yeah.
And I remember you stayed at home, didn't you? And you were on the phone the moment it came.
Yeah, he'd got online, yeah.
Hunter got a press ticket.
Yeah.
Did you get your... Where did you get your ticket from?
Yeah, I was in the press box. So.
Okay, so essentially, being a loyal Spurs fan and being journalists, what a fairly... easy route to getting tickets, but then you were stumped, weren't you, of how are you going to get there? And there was all sorts of talk of £1,000 airline tickets. I don't mean we didn't consider that, but people were paying astronomical amounts to get there. So it's nice to hear how it. What was the food like on the way down? Was it
the food?
Was it motorway fare or
the food at
bistro
at this campsite that we stayed at on the Friday night was really good. So Tony had. Belatedly had an amazing steak.
Yeah.
The other Tony and myself both had octopus, which was absolutely incredible, and I genuinely haven't stopped talking about it
since.
I went
on a date with an octopus once. It was all hands.
and what was it you had, Hunter, to eat?
Hamburger.
Yeah, hamburger.
Hamburger. I really fancied a hamburger.
Kids menu.
I don't know.
In France, it was hamburger.
Do you know what I did find out, though, is French motorway services have a pool. Which, you know, that
swimming
made my
pool.
Day. No, as in, like, pool, the lovely patisserie.
Okay, oh, moving pool. On.
You asked what the food. You asked what the food was like.
We call a pool.
Yeah, fair play. Okay, well, listen, let's... people have sitting there, I'm going, this podcast used to be good. So let's just get on to the football. I don't think anyone considered that after such amazing semi-finals that the final will be such a really... I mean, people were saying, look, that friendly, tense. What were you... Who wants to start, the victor or the loser?
Well, it's funny because I think everyone watched that Europa League final on the Wednesday evening, and a lot of people were saying it was like one of those kind of pre-season friendlies,
yeah.
You know, Premier League Asia Trophy in Singapore or China
Makita
or wherever.
Makita Trophy type thing.
Yeah, where, you know, no one was really kind of at it and it didn't feel like there was the intensity that you would normally expect in a game between two Premier League teams. You know, if you look at the two games between Spurs and City in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, you'd say that was like an amped up Premier League game.
Yeah.
And the Europa League game was a kind of a bit of an anti-climax. Mm-hmm. I don't think many people expected the same to happen in the Champions League final. But it really did. It was just...
It was over familiarity, I think. I think if it had been Liverpool Ajax, it would have been a very different... Or Spurs Spurs Barcelona, it would have been a very different sort of game.
3 weeks is a long time to break between the end of the season and the Champions League final. It's the longest it's ever been, right, because the Premier League started early this year.
Hunter, what was the atmosphere like in the stadium?
It was in the lead up to the game. They had, when the Spurs go marching in, they had "You'll Never Walk Alone," and the Spurs and Liverpool fans were sort of singing at each other, and it was great. And then UEFA started rolling out their sort of pre-game nonsense.
Imagine Dragons
for 10 minutes.
What?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the band they chose to.
What were they called?
Imagine Dragons.
Okay.
They played for 10 minutes. They had the Champions League song on a
violin.
Forget
all that. What was it like with the fans?
Well, after that, it killed it. It was great before that.
Were you
that.
In with the fans,
building up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So as Hunter says, the atmosphere was really ramping up really nicely in kind of a 20 minutes before the game. Then all of this kind of UEFA pre-match gubbin starts going on. You get kids on the pitch with drums and loads of, you know.
Looked like Beijing.
Over elaborate. Yeah, exactly. It was like 2008 Olympics. Absolute nonsense. And you get like 10 minutes of that. And it completely kills the atmosphere.
It was flat.
It stops
really?
It there.
Really? Is that right?
And you've got to ramp
even
it up
for
again.
Liverpool.
Oh yeah, yeah, very much.
The
so.
Thing was,
I the
was
sense of European entitlement.
Yeah, it didn't really get going until the end. You know, it's until they got the cup. It probably one of the flattest atmospheres I've ever seen.
That's
in
really
final.
Weird.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Do you think it was nerves or?
No, I think UEFA have just contrived to kill the whole thing. You know, it's like they did the best. I mean, the football. I mean, I think it was very hot in there. I mean, you know, it was bacon, and I think Liverpool had basically set plan to to miss out the midfield to knock the ball long, because they were overrun in the second half of the Premier League game at Anfield when Tottenham went to a flat four in midfield. So especially because they were one up, they just knocked it long and said, "Come back, Evers," and Tottenham didn't have enough to come back.
What did it look like? What was it like being in the press box? You two, did you? Do you have television screens showing you the replays?
Yeah.
In your booth?
There was one for about every four people. There was just one in the centre.
So what did you think as a Spurs fan? Now, to me, I thought as a neutral, it was definitely a penalty. Altered the direction.
Well, as soon as it hits
and it doesn't matter if it is chest first. It's like bat and pad. You know, you get.
I think if you're going by the letter of the law, which UEFA have made really clear, that's exactly how they're going to do handball from now on. They've written the rule. They're going to stick to it. It's a penalty, and you can't really argue with it. Mm. So,
and what did it look like in the stand? From the stand, James, did you not really know what was going on?
When you've had a few beers and you're in the Spurs end, and that penalty is given after 30 seconds, that is definitely not a penalty, and everyone was absolutely certain about that. And I don't want to sound like a bad journalist. I haven't actually seen it again, and I hope I never do. but I'm still certain it definitely wasn't a penalty.
It was a pen. I find that when I'm in the crowd. I mean, I don't drink anymore, so maybe I don't have the vision impaired by alcohol, but. I'll be standing at a game surrounded by Leeds, in an away game surrounded by Leeds fans, and you'll hear people screaming. And it obviously wasn't what they were screaming for. You know, it was our player. It's bizarre that people can't see. Sometimes when it is questionable or it is wrong, then you've every right to be forthright about it. But anyway, moving along, I thought it was early. You know, that's that weird thing about early to score or too early to score. I don't think it gives safety scoring that early.
Well, no, it
shouldn't. You know what I mean? What do you think about that?
Well, you know,
is it an advantage? Obviously, you're 1-0 up, but that early in the game.
I think it depends on the game and the teams, doesn't it? And the mentality of the team.
You know, you probably, if there's only one goal in it, or, you know, it's going to be close, you better score in the last minute than the first. You know, but, I mean, you know, people said afterwards, and they were saying all night, oh, you know, the early goal killed the game. That's what happens with early goals. And I was like, well, I remember Istanbul when, you know, Milan scored early on. And that turned out quite exciting in the end, you know. So it shouldn't have. I mean, clearly it's affected Liverpool's tactics. And you know, they changed the way they played. And they basically said to Tottenham, come on to us, and thinking about hitting them on the break. But, you know, that was the cue for Tottenham to actually put some, you know, get some pattern of play together. They had loads of possession. They had their opportunity. And the reason the game was so dull is because Spurs just didn't play at all.
Right, now, talking about selection, the Harry Kane selection, before you guys went, we were talking in the 442 office. And again, as somebody who's not watching Spurs week in, week out, but who saw an amazing performance in the semi-final by Moura. I was saying, my feeling is he's got to play. When you have a, there are just 11 people, we forget that. And when you go in with a player with the amount of confidence and belief, and to not have started him, I felt was a mistake. And I think that actually, at the time, James, you came back and said, well, you know, you were quoting how few times he'd scored before and how a few goals you'd scored without Harry Kane. But Southgate didn't play him last night, and obviously didn't play anyone from that final. But the perception was he didn't play him because he wasn't fit. James, do you feel in retrospect that, you know, he maybe shouldn't have started?
I mean, I think I there was probably an argument before that, even without the benefit of hindsight.
But you told me absolutely that he should play.
Oh, no. What I said was that he would play. I didn't say necessarily that he should play. I was 100% certain that he would play. You know, Harry Kane is more than just Spurs' best player. He's like the kind of poster boy of the whole club. And he's the leader of the dressing room, possibly the most popular player at the club, within the club. To not, you know, I mean, maybe you could compare him to Gerrard at Liverpool in that kind of Istanbul era.
What was the stat that you told me before? Did you say that Spurs had only scored 2 league goals in the 5 games he was missing?
It was something like that. It was more games than that, wasn't it? I mean, it was basically when they went off the boil at the end of the season
in the Premier
without
League,
Kane
yeah.
in the what season. In the Premier League.
You know, I can't remember the exact stats, but yeah, in the Premier League.
What do you think? Do you think he should have started?
Because
again, neither of you said
it was a gamble that's not come off.
It
basically,
was, yeah, it was always going to be a gamble, and it was the only person who knew was Pochettino. But I've said it before; he would have watched him in training. He knows if he's sharp. I don't think there's a question he's fit. He can run for 90 minutes. He did run for 90 minutes, but a question of how sharp he is. And Spurs fans have seen him come back from these injuries over the last few seasons, and they know that it takes him a few games to get going. Even if you watch him at the beginning of most Premier League seasons, it takes him a few games. You know, there's that common saying that he doesn't score in August. Oh, he can't score in August. But that's because it takes him 6 or 7 games to really...
I think it was a pity. I think if you look at the history of English national football, when things have changed for the better in 1986, when Peter Beardsley emerged because Hately was injured, the most famous one, obviously, 1966, when Jimmy Greaves, who... I don't remember Greaves as a player, but he, you know, you read the stats, he is the most prolific in terms of the most effective in terms of goals per games England striker ever. And anybody who did see him, who's like probably in their late 50s or early 60s now, just say it was absolutely amazing. And Ramsey left him out for the player that had come in for him, Jeff Hurst. Same with David Platt coming in. Same with Gazza coming in for Brian Robson in 1990. I just think you go with momentum. And what did you feel as on the Liverpool side? I think Liverpool always tend to think about themselves rather than the opposition. The strength, Klopp seems to be confident in his own team rather than worry about the opposition. But were you happy that Kane was playing and Moura was on the bench?
Yeah, I think everyone was delighted. I know that at Anfield they were pleased about it because, you know, I was talking to Graham Souness on Wednesday, name dropping, of course, and the interview will be in 442 very soon. But he was talking about Kane. He said, I can't believe it. He said Kane put Pochettino on the spot when he declared himself fit. Mm-hmm. So that you know, made Pochettino's decision much more awkward. He said, but when you come back from injury, he said, you need 2 games to get sharpness. You know, you need 2 games to get match fit. He said, you know, you can run. He said, but, you know, you don't have the pace. You're not up with the pace of the game. He said, you know, you need 2 runouts. And Kane didn't have that. And it showed. He just, you know, his touch was off. His movement wasn't ideal. You know, it wasn't great. And he was just off the player he normally is. And he was dropping. I mean, he's got a habit in the last year or so. We were talking about this on the way of dropping deeper and deeper. And he was almost at the halfway line on occasions. And you don't want Harry Kane in that area. You know, it was. And when Moura come on, he gave Tottenham an energy they hadn't had up till then. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, they started to trouble Liverpool down the middle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had a few shots. They had, I wouldn't quite say they were chances, but they certainly knocked Liverpool out the comfort zone. And had Moura been playing from the beginning, I think it might have been a very different game.
I think that. I think if you score a hat trick in the semi final of the Champions League, you. that the energy and the confidence that that instills in you would be infectious.
You've got to question Ali's place in that starting 11, just because, as you said, Lucas has scored a hat-trick in his last game. Ali's not had a great time in the Premier League. He's not looked like himself. He looks like a man who's a bit lost at the moment. And then you think about what Tony said. He comes on through the middle, but if he'd started through the middle, Kane gets a lot more support through the middle. He doesn't have to drop as deep. It changes the whole complexion of that midfield.
Tell us a little bit about Dele Alli, because the amount of excitement about him, I mean, there was talk about Barcelona coming in from the season before last. What's happening with him?
I think it's been a tough season for Dele. He's definitely looked tired after the World Cup, basically. Mm. And this season, he's picked up two or three niggling but quite extended injuries for the first time in his career. So he's coming back from them. He's having to deal with that. I still don't think he knows what his best position is. Pochettino uses him quite... it gives him quite a varied role at Tottenham. He still doesn't have a set position, which mm-hmm. I think would actually help him in terms of growing into his own game.
What position do you think, James, is Dele Alli's? You see Spurs...
His best return in terms of goals and assists was the 2016-17 season, where for most of it he was playing effectively as like a second striker. Mm-hmm. So he's playing off Kane, making those late runs into the box. He's got quite a few headers that season, including a couple against Chelsea in a Premier League game. Mm-hmm. He was kind of ghosting into that space and scoring a lot of goals. He was still getting a lot of assists and scoring some great goals from the edge of the box as well. But that just seemed to be where he shone the most consistently, maybe not in terms of all the kind of flicks and tricks that we've seen from him in other seasons, but purely in terms of the output and in terms of numbers, that was his best season. The problem obviously Spurs have got now is that Heung-Min Son has come into prominence to such an extent that he needs to kind of be facilitated in that system as well. And it's very difficult to have Kane as your focal point, Dele Alli playing in behind, Son playing on the left or the right, kind of cutting in as well. You can't really commit to having that many attacking players, given you're going to want to have another wide player around Eriksen too. And I think the fluidity that has resulted in that kind of front three or the three behind the striker when they've played like that has caused him more problems than it's helped him.
Okay, so that's Spurs. I mean, watching it, I thought Spurs were really coming into it again. And I thought, you know, if they looked the more likely team, you know, as they went through the second half. But obviously that didn't happen, and Liverpool clinched the second goal. Tony, what has this done to Klopp's stature in world football?
Oh, well, it puts him up there with, you know, with the proper serious managers. You know, at Anfield, as soon as he arrived, they put his face on flags and all that, and it was premature. You know, you have to actually win something to be up there with the Paisleys, you know, the Shankleys and even Benitez, you know, and he's reached that level now. Now the big thing for him is to kick on and to maintain this. Because I mean, in 2005, you know, Benitez won the Champions League, went back 2 years later, you know, and got beaten in the final, won the FA Cup in between. But all that momentum stopped then, mm-hmm. and the club went backwards. So what he's going to do, the big job and the big test for him now is to take them forward and to keep the progression going, which obviously means an attempt to win the league. Back to Istanbul next year in the Champions League. But he's in a great position, because City are about to go to war with UEFA, mm-hmm. and that's going to have an effect on them one way or another. The other members of the so-called Big Six are way behind Liverpool. And if, you know, he should be able to keep the squad together, particularly mm-hmm. this summer after winning this, one or two judicious buys, and suddenly you've got a club that's, you know, sitting pretty compared to everyone else in the Premier League.
Can I just ask you mentioned Graham Souness, who I know you're profiling for us. What does he think of Klopp?
Well, he thinks he's done a great job, but he thinks it's taken him a fair while to get things right, but there were endemic problems in the club that he had to address. Yeah. But he agrees with me on that subject, he was saying the same thing to me. He said, Liverpool are in as good a position as any. He said, like, what they've got to do is change the mentality. He said, when we were playing and we only won one trophy, we'd turn up for pre-season training for the picture, the squad picture. If there was only one trophy on the picture, you'd be like, oh, you know, we need more than that. He said, they've got to get that mentality. And he was talking about how, you know, when they won the European Cup, as it was then, the Champions League, he said they'd have about 20 minutes, half an hour of celebrating. He said, and then the staff would come in and take all the medals off them. And they'd say...
Straight after it.
And they'd say to them, like, yeah, that's over now. You got to think about the next one. You've won nothing next season. And what would happen is to come...
So this would be under Bob Paisley?
Yeah. And Shankly, yeah. And they'd come back to pre-season training on the first pre-season day of pre-season training, one of them would come in with a box and put the box on the table and say, there's some medals there. If you think you deserve them for last year, you know, take them. But, you know, remember, they're not for this year. And, you know, and that was the attitude.
Hard.
Yeah, very, very hard. And he was saying, Klopp's going to be like that. You know, for example, Origi scores and he becomes a... You know, he becomes a hero, and everyone always put him in the pantheon of European Cup, Champions League, you know, goal scorers and all that. But he's not good enough. You know, get him out of there now this summer. You know, sell him. People pay a premium because he scored an high-profile game. Get someone who can actually play in a Klopp team.
Two high-profile games.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, he can't play...
the most important games in the Liverpool calendar, possibly. Everton and... final.
Well, three Barcelona as well. So, you know. Yeah. But you know, that notwithstanding, he's not good enough. So, you know.
I mean, how can he not be good enough?
He can't play. He's not mobile enough to play in a Klopp team. He's not intelligent enough to play.
You're sure he's good enough to do what he does?
Well, yeah.
Which is like, you know, Ronnie Rosenthal was a much better striker than he's remembered as. Mm. I imagine David Fairclough was probably a better striker than he's remembered as being a super sub. But surely he's got a part to play.
Yeah, but I mean...
You're saying sell Divock.
I'm saying, yeah, get him out of there, not good enough. Take a look at the squad, say he was not good enough. You know, say, this. We want to have a squad that can win the Champions League again, that can retain the trophy and win the title and win more trophies. So you know what? Anyone who's dead wood, get rid of them.
I think a striker that you could pick up is Patrick Bamford and Divock... could come to Leeds. That would work. He's actually a lethal finisher when he finishes. You know, when he takes the chance, it looks good. He's a class player. I was talking to someone earlier who works at a football club who regretted, I know Middlesbrough regret selling him.
Mm.
He's class. He's what you need. And send Origi to us.
Well, you know, I reckon...
He's looking at me like I'm being serious.
No, not at all. I'm a big fan of Bamford. And I think he's got the mobility to work better in the club system, so I can see the point there. And I think Origi would score loads of goals.
Could you mention it to him? Mention it, maybe put it into...
Yeah, I'll give him a call.
You've got a few friends at Anfield. Yeah. Maybe you could just say Bamford, you know, it's an unlikely one, but... Leeds let him go for about, I think, 14 million.
Mm. I'm not sure Bamford's... Is it the clarinet he plays? He plays a kind of middle
violin.
Class. Is it violin?
I think he's
I'm not
violin.
Sure that would really fit with anyway. The rock and roll football of Jurgen Klopp.
Listen, let's move it on. I've reduced it to level of the Championship from the Champions League. Is there anything else you want to say, summing up? How do you feel about Spurs' season? It's a tremendous experience to get there. They've never got that far in the Champions League before.
Yeah, I think it might be a thing that the kind of magnitude of it isn't quite hit home to Spurs fans maybe until some way into next season when perhaps, maybe even when they're playing in the Champions League again. As you say, it's an incredible achievement for a club like Spurs who, as much as we might like to claim are a big club, are absolutely nowhere near the level of Liverpool, particularly when you consider the history and experience of playing in that competition. There's been a few comparisons between the Spurs side of this season and the Liverpool side of last season, purely because both finished fourth in the Premier League and both lost the Champions League final. What Liverpool did at that point was back their manager. Well, they'd already done that in January by signing the centre-back that they desperately needed. Then they went out in the summer and signed two midfielders to really bulk up in that area of the pitch and a goalkeeper that obviously has made a massive difference to the team. Well, this is my point.
Good. I'm glad we're getting to it.
If Spurs go out and spend 100, 150, 200 million pounds on three or four, five new players, then they'll have a chance of repeating what they've done this season. I mean,
do
obviously,
you think that's going to happen?
I suspect possibly not.
Hello, Pete Donaldson here from the Football Ramble. Now, one of the things we love most about football is actually playing the game. We're currently sponsored by the National Lottery. Now, every time you play, you help fund thousands of local football projects right across the country, developing the game at the all-important grassroots level and hopefully ensuring that the next generation of football players can comfortably play out from the back. You also help to raise around £30 million a week for good causes. That, my friends, is a whole Moussa Sissoko. The National Lottery. Amazing starts here.
This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.
Okay, let's move on to the future, not the past. Hunter, on Sunday, you were travelling to the city of Nice, which is nice.
Yeah, should be nice.
To see England-Scotland in the Women's World Cup.
Yeah, the first game for the England team. Should be, it's a big one, you know, that when we spoke to some of the Lionesses, for this recent feature,
which is the cover story.
They were saying that there are quite a few Scottish players at Man City. There's a couple at Chelsea as well, and that they were saying that this was the one that they'd all sort of earmarked as this was the big one. Obviously, the first game of a World Cup always going to be big anyway. Yeah. But there's a fair amount of rivalry there.
What time is it on?
French time it's 5 o'clock. No, English time it's 5 o'clock. Okay. French time will be 6 o'clock. Yes, so yeah, on Sunday.
So that means it'll be on a different time on French TV.
Yeah, 6 o'clock.
We're all a little jet lagged still.
Yeah,
it's a great way to start the tournament, right, for England. Anyway, to play against Scotland. I mean, that's the kind of fixture that will really capture people's imagination. I mean, I think they've never played Scotland in a men's World Cup. I don't think they have. I mean, obviously, in Euro 96, yes. Mm. But I don't think in a World Cup.
Not in a World Cup.
No. So it's quite exciting to have a game like that to start it all up. Get people into the swing of it. And, you know, 4 years ago, England did fantastically well, got to the semi-final, finished in third place. But the games, because it was in Canada, the games were all on late in the evening. Mm. And that makes it a lot more difficult for people to watch. I think they were on kind of 11 o'clock midnight. Yeah. This time around, obviously, it's in France, and as we've just established at great length, it's only 1 hour ahead. So the games will be on at sensible times, and people will be able to watch, and people will get behind this team. They're a likeable team, lots of fantastic players there. So it should be a really great tournament, and obviously, England are among the favourites. So
there's a fascinating story within the England team that we've got in the magazine of one of the players, Farah, was homeless when she was first being selected for England. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. The stories that the women have to go through to get to play, even for the national team, is incredible. Most of them have thought about dropping out. Most of them have thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. And yet here they are, they're representing their country. And women's football is finally starting to gather the momentum that it should have had for, you know, the last 100 years.
Yeah. And you interviewed a couple of them, didn't you?
Yeah, I spoke to Kira Walsh and Demi Stokes. Kira's quite a lot younger than Demi, she's just getting started. But I mean, even talking to her, she never really watched women's football. She didn't even know it was really a thing. So her reference point of women's football has been just playing it again, just because it doesn't have the coverage.
Well, we've got I think we've interviewed six of the Lionesses, and a big interview with Fran Kirby, who they call the mini Messi. And we got a brilliant overview of it by Susie Rack, who's the Guardian's women's football writer. And it's, I felt after reading that piece that, you know, after reading all of the pieces, that they genuinely feel at last like there's the support there from, you know, for girls in their early teens to be, you know, that the sport is being taken seriously. And I know that we work with Nike on this. They're very keen to, and really, not just keen, you know, they're really, really involved in developing women's football. So will it be a sellout on Sunday? Will that stadium be full?
I think, I can't remember the exact numbers. They said out of the 50-odd games, there was a 50% sellout at the moment.
That'll pick up.
It will pick up, of course. The tickets aren't expensive, and you know they're trying to get more people involved this year.
But the French, one of you was saying, Hunter or your Connor was saying that the French, there's not a lot of coverage of it in the French media yet.
Yeah, well, the tennis tournament that's currently going on is getting a lot of coverage, but the Women's World Cup is not. Susie Rack, like you said, is out in Paris, and she was tweeting yesterday morning that if you were walking the streets, you wouldn't know that a major tournament was kicking off this evening. You wouldn't know the World Cup was going on there.
What I will say is that the French team's kit is great.
Oh God, yeah, home and away, both absolutely gorgeous.
You've got a page in the mix, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's probably. Do you think it's the best one that you've seen for the World Cup?
I'd say yeah. Well, actually, we were just writing our top 20 kits of the Women's World Cup, and it is number one and number three of the home and away kits.
That England away kit is great as well.
Why are you doing that?
Because it'll get a load of clicks. It gets loads of clicks.
Oh, sorry, you're doing it online?
Yeah, we're doing it online.
I thought you and Connor were just sitting around.
No, we're doing it.
Hey, you should be putting it at number four.
It's written.
What's that? Is it on the Instagram or is it on the Twitter?
No, it'll just be on. It's on the site.
On the website.
It'll get loads and loads of clicks.
The Edmonton process in action.
Okay, well, we should just say,
Connor, leave this in.
If anyone's sitting there going, oh, why is it like four men talking about women's football? We've got women's football editor Claire. We've had Anna Kessel has interviewed Frank Kirby. Susie Rack. They're all at the World Cup, which is like, you know, we didn't just want to get anyone in who didn't know.
And the other thing is, like, you know, we need, it doesn't matter what your sex is when you watch football and you report on football. You know, we need more women writing about men's football. And, you know, men can write about women's football. I think it should be, I mean, obviously, there's more experts on women's football. Women are experts, and they're more qualified to talk about it than, say, me. But, you know, it's they'll get loads of coverage over the next few weeks. And I think...
It'll build.
Yeah, as long as the women's game gets the coverage and gets the interest and grows, I don't think it matters who talks about it.
It is worth saying that 442 was started by a woman. Mm. Yeah. Okay, let's move on very quickly. In and out, England, Holland. James.
They're out.
Out. what's your take on where England are? I mean, Hunter mentioned the period of time between the end of the season and Champions League final. John Stones was culpable for a couple of goals. Has hardly played.
Yeah, I mean, he was in and out of the team towards the back end of the season anyway, wasn't he, at City?
Any positives for you?
I, to be honest, I mean, for the first 70 minutes maybe of the game, it was like a kind of competent, comfortable performance, and it looked like England would kind of hold on and win and go through to the final against Portugal and lose that instead. But they kind of lost a little bit of concentration and conceded a goal from a set piece that was probably preventable.
Do you think the team's too young?
I don't think there's really an alternative, is there?
Well, yeah, you just pick older players.
Yeah, but there aren't any. There aren't any that are...
There's always players.
Yeah, but not of the standard of international footballers. Well,
I think as long as they go away from this and when they get together again in the autumn, they go, OK, let's look at the mistakes we made.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have a year's more experience, you know, by the time that the tournament comes round next season, the Euros, you know, let's learn from it. Let's not do stupid things. If we're going to pass out from the back, let's make sure we can do it. And if we can't, pump the bloody ball up the pitch. Mm. You know, it's let's play to our strengths. And England, the young England players have loads of strengths, and you know, they should be able to build on where they were last year in Russia. In the World Cup, but I mean, they're going to have these tough learning curves. The Dutch have improved out of all recognition over the past 18 months, and you know, and I think one of the things I talked to Marcus Rashford a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying they went through a spell where they thought they were doing well, they thought they were improving, but every time they come up against a good team, they'd lose. He said, you know, and that's what they've got to change that. They've got to be able to beat the good teams. And we're seeing that they're still not quite at the standard where they want to be. Of course, there was the Liverpool and Tottenham players left out, and that'll make a difference.
Definitely.
But I think England are still in a pretty good place.
That's good.
Sorry, I was just going to say that midfield trio probably won't be the trio next summer either, which is the big, that'll be the revolving door of England. Because Fabian Delph hasn't played central midfield for Man City this season, and yet he's starting in a Euro Nations semi-final. I don't know, you make your own mind up whether that's a big game or not.
Well, you know, for me, I think that there was a good piece on The Guardian, I think, about his influence in the dressing room. Sometimes there are things go on in football clubs that we don't see, which is about the what you were talking about the medals. You know, there's a lot to do with football about mentality. We only ever see performance. So anyway, look.
Rashford was saying exactly the same thing about Delph. Yeah. He said, he was impressed the most in the squads, and who surprised him. And he said, Harry Kane impressed him most because he's just brilliant. He said, but Delph was the one who surprised him. He said because he's he keeps the younger lads in line. He's not scared of a laugh and a joke with them.
Particularly the captain. Yeah. Last night. Sterling has spoken about how Delph has been a big influence on him, and maybe there's some thinking there.
Yeah, and he said, like, you know, he makes sure everyone has fun, but after the work's done, he's very focused. So he was very he praised him an awful lot.
Okay, we've only got a few minutes left. We are going to talk about Andy's Maradona piece in the coming weeks on the podcast. But it's been picked up so extensively across the media, from the broadcaster, television channels, to the radio, to the print, digital, everywhere. It's been everywhere, and I knew it would be when we put. That's why I went with the headline saying, you know, if Man United need a coach, I'm the man. I'll just give a bit of background. This Chris Flanagan, who sits is one of our staff writers. He said, "Why don't we try and get an interview with Maradona? Or he's in Dorados, the second tier in Mexico." This was really around the new film that's coming out, Diego, which is great. I've seen it, and it's a really, really good film. It just tells the story of his time in Napoli, which was amazing. It's basically like being on the tour with the Rolling Stones in 1971. And the most interesting voice in that film isn't Maradona, isn't the guy who ran Napoli. It's Maradona's personal fitness coach, because he basically admits that Maradona was caning it on over the weekend.
That's
after
the hardest job in football,
but
right?
He talks about his amazing commitment. So we said, look, what can we do beyond just getting everybody was going to talk to the producer and the director and so on? So Chris said, let's do it. And I asked Irving Welsh if he could do it, because Irving's often based out of Miami and he's got two or three films in development, so he couldn't. Then asked a writer, a very good writer, who does a lot of crime reporting out in LA, Jeff Mache, but he was unable to do it. And Andy said, yeah, I'll do it, because he speaks Spanish. So we set off, and we had no idea. It was just literally, we'd spoken to Dorados. They said, come, we'll make you welcome, but he doesn't do anything. And so Andy left England on the Sunday night, straight after the Man United game. He had his brother waiting in a car. He left the Man United game 5 minutes earlier. Flew to Paris, flew back over to Manchester to get to Mexico. Then a Monday night, so Tuesday morning, 3 a.m., I was awake, and I got a text, just appeared. It was a picture of Maradona reading the issue of 442 with Solskjaer and Bielsa, those pieces. And I was just lying in bed on my own, laughing my head off. I couldn't believe it. And so I rang Andy and he said, yep, got him. Great. I can't believe it. And that is the story of how he got there. I've given you the details of how he originated. But the story of where he is, and Maradona came over and spoke to him, and Andy spent some time with his family. It's not a major in-depth interview. If you want to get an in-depth look at Maradona, go and see the film, because he talks a lot through it. But as an editor, it was just absolutely fantastic for one of the staff to come up with that idea. Everyone, kind of get involved in should we do it or not, and then for him to go off and execute it. I'm not going to say any more about it, but do go and get it. I think if there wasn't the opportunity for the first time to put an all-female front cover together, I think we would have gone with Maradona on the cover there. And in the interview, he talks about who he rates, who is the best British midfielders. I'll give you one of them. One of them played for Manchester United, one of them played for Liverpool. And both of them have been managers. Is that right? Yeah, both of them have been managers. So get that. He's definitely, if you're interested in Maradona anyway, do get this issue because it's a brilliant interview. And you'll only have had a snippet if you've seen those quotes elsewhere. And
a lot of people talk about, you know, Messi being the greatest ever, and generally in my experience they're the people who didn't see Maradona. You know, if you don't know enough about Maradona, and no one can know enough about Maradona, if you don't know about Maradona, get the issue, find out about him, because this was the greatest footballer of all time.
It's interesting.
Yeah, without a doubt. He was just unbelievable.
It's nice to hear that, because when we were talking about it, it was like, where is he now? Because of the emergence of Ronaldo. And the simple fact is, if you watch the film Diego, football is much easier now. You have to be fitter, and there's probably greater pressures. You know, everything is filmed and followed on social media. But on the pitch, watch the film, but then also where he is working now is fascinating. There are certain parallels in the, not in his lifestyle, but in his, you know, in the background and the region and who he hung out with in Napoli and what the place where he's working is famous for now. But definitely go and do it. Okay, so thanks, James Moore, Tony Evans, Hunter Godson. It was great to hear about your trip. What was the best thing that happened that had nothing to do with football in the van?
for me, it was like, and it wasn't the best thing because it was terrible, but it was the absolute destruction of the double bed that turned us into from a four berth camper van into a two berth on the first night before we'd even had any sleep. And you know,
well, after we had had a few beers, to be
what
fair.
Happened?
And Hunter took out the table and put it down and did everything you're supposed to do. But
an upper bunk?
Yeah, no, it was a table that you put down and you collapse it to make a bed.
Definitely collapsed, to be fair.
During the collapsing process, the stands have come off.
With all four of you lying next to each other on one massive bed. Was that the sleeping arrangement?
Well, it might have been if we could have got the bed to wear. And then to make it worse, we pulled out the other part of the bed, and it was all pulled up, but we couldn't make the bed up because the table was broken. Because we're men. And then I attempted to gently push that back, and the ball bearings just went ping everywhere. You know, it was like, so I mean,
the damage you were talking about earlier.
That was part of the damage. That was part one of the damage.
Can I just ask a question? Was it insured by the company that lent us the van?
And by Future, both. But
yeah. We're fine.
Yeah.
The
light socket, that
whoever's
was
idea
brought
this
out.
Was wrong.
Ah, I forgot about the light socket.
The light socket was just that was a mistake.
What do you mean the light socket was a mistake? What did you have plugged in there?
Phone. They have little USB chargers in the light sockets, which is a great idea. But then someone was charging their phone and I sat on their phone and the phone just went and just yanked out of the...
Oh, the socket came out.
The socket came out, full light came out. And then when first moment we got to Calais...
Can I just stop you here? Is this consistent with what you're going to put in the damage report?
Oh, yeah, we've already reported all the damage. Yeah. And they've said... As long as you didn't mean to do it, and none of it will be seen.
When I took it back, the guy said to me, he said, "Oh, this is next to nothing." I mean, I clipped the curb and the side was just the bumper. The just bumper come loose. I tell you what, it sounds. I've been in earthquakes. I've been in 7.5 earthquakes, the San Andreas fault, and the crack when I hit the curb was louder than the earthquake. Yeah, I thought it destroyed the whole thing. And when I got out and saw how little damage there was, I was like, Jesus.
Yeah. Right, okay.
But yeah, I mean...
So anyway,
this has been the 442 podcast. Do get the latest issue of the magazine. Features Andy Mitten's interview with Maradona, Susie Rack on the Lionesses, Irvin Welsh on Hibs, and the amazing story of the kidnapping of Alfredo Di Stefano, when he was the world's top player in the 50s. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast via Spotify and iTunes. And you can follow us on Twitter at 442. What's Instagram?
At 442UK.
Okay, thanks, Hunter. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Thank you.
This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.